From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, huge circulation drops at the Detroit News and Free Press. What's at risk as we rely on free online news?
You can find tons of Barack Obama or Jennifer Aniston news, but you can't find news about your state or in many places, even your local community. And to me, that's very dangerous from the standpoint of democracy.
How Breast Cancer Awareness Month overlooks the financial crunch of breast cancer.
They've been diagnosed with breast cancer, and they've either been forced to leave their position or their side effects are so challenging they can no longer perform their job.
And sports commentator John Eubacon previews the Michigan-Michigan State game.
Calling them little brother gets a bit old, and they keep kicking your butt.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. New numbers are out on newspaper circulation in Michigan, and they aren't pretty. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the future of print news. And then sports commentator John Eubacon is here.
If Brady Hoke loses his game, the head coach, the pitchforks and torches come out, and your job is, if it's not lost, it is really close to being lost.
We'll get a preview from John of the Michigan-Michigan State game later this hour. But first, we're less than 2 weeks away from Election Day, but for plenty of voters, the election has already come and gone. As Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta explains, a growing number of voters are choosing to cast absentee ballots.
With each election cycle, more and more voters are not showing up at the polls, choosing instead to mail in or drop off their ballots before Election Day.
My name is Jackie Payne, and I am a resident of Lansing, Michigan, Ingham County. And a registered voter. I have, to my knowledge, never missed a vote since I've been eligible to vote.
And Payne has been voting absentee since she turned 60 and qualified automatically for an absentee ballot. That's one of the six reasons under Michigan law that people can use to qualify to vote absentee.
And there's the ballot. So, let's see. Official ballot, general election, Tuesday, November 4th, 2014, Ingham County, Michigan, City of Lansing, Ward 4, Precinct 37. That's me.
By the time Election Day rolls around, as many as a third of the voters participating in Michigan elections will have already cast their ballots.
We are definitely having an increase over what we had 4 years ago in the last gubernatorial election.
Chris Swope is the Lansing City Clerk. He says absentee voting this year almost certainly won't match what comes in during a presidential election when interest is higher and more people vote, but he says interest in voting absentee is growing.
We're definitely seeing more people requesting absentee ballots, and it seems like we're having a pretty steady stream of mailed applications, faxed applications, scanned and emailed applications coming in.
Swope's office participated in an experiment launched this year by the state Democratic Party to make it easier for people to submit their absentee ballot applications electronically using a website to email or fax applications.
We've got to do a better job. There's, you know, the internet just wasn't invented last year.
State Democratic Party Chair Lon Johnson says it's part of his drive to get Democrats who don't turn out for midterms to still participate. Johnson says his party is reaching out to voters not only to get them to apply for absentee ballots, but then to fill them out and mail them in.
We've identified those folks. We're messaging them. We're knocking on their doors. We're making the phone calls. We're sending them EV applications. We're going to work to turn them out. If we do that, we win. If we don't, we lose. It's that simple.
Republicans also have an absentee voter program. Both parties keep track of requests for absentee ballots and will try to make sure voters get campaign literature, maybe a phone call or a home visit before they fill out their ballot. Darren Littell of the Michigan Republican Party says the GOP targets registered voters on their list who score high as loyal Republicans but have a spotty record for showing up at the polls.
If we can get a voter to send in their ballot now, then that's one less voter that we have to focus on Election Day.
And political operations targeting absentee voters will certainly play an even bigger part in future elections as more voters choose to vote early, especially if Michigan one day joins the 27 other states and Washington, D.C. that allow no-reason absentee voting. Because, especially in low turnout years, close and even some not-so-close races could be decided by the ballots cast before Election Day. For the Michigan Public Radio Network, I'm Rick Pluta in Lansing.
The Detroit Institute of Arts was left with egg on its face as news broke of double-digit pay increases and big bonuses doled out to its two top executives. Bonuses and increases given in 2012. That was just as the DIA convinced voters in three Southeast Michigan counties to say yes to a special millage to keep the DIA open. Well, now a firestorm of protest is pushing the DIA to rethink bonuses and salaries. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here now. Remind us again, Daniel, what kind of money are we talking about for Director Graham Beal and COO Anne-Marie Erickson?
For Graham Beal, it's a little over $500,000. And for Anne-Marie, the specific number escapes me, $370,000, that's what it is. She got a 36% raise back in, I think, 2012. And the filings just have just been made available. And my colleague, Jennifer Chambers, wrote about this and really blew the lid off here because of the optics of this whole thing. You have a museum that's getting roughly two-thirds of its operating budget from taxpayers and then turning around and giving large raises and $50,000 bonuses each to the top two executives. And this has naturally created a backlash, particularly in Oakland County, where you had some commissioners that were talking about dissolving the Oakland Arts Authority, which would essentially stop $11 million on an annual basis from going to the DIA. So the DIA has now come back full circle and has said that they will look at these procedures. This kind of thing will not happen again because they're trying to tamp this down. The last thing they need is to see $11 million disappear from their operating budget. It would throw everything into total disarray.
And give me an idea. How does benchmark this for us? How does the money that Erickson and Beal are making compare with other major art institutions?
It's very comparable. I don't think that's really the issue. It's not that anybody is arguing that they are wildly overcompensated for the jobs they do at the institutions that they run. I think that that's not the issue here. The issue is public funding, and I think also the optics. And finally, the sensitivity. I mean, let's be real here. The bankruptcy that is about to be over, we think, sometime next month potentially, hinged on the grand bargain. And the grand bargain, one of the key pieces of it was rescuing the DIA and its prodigious collection from creditors and making sure that those pieces did not get sold to satisfy creditors. And they successfully did that. There was an unprecedented coalition of state lawmakers, foundations, then more recently corporate foundations and others who came together to save this institution. And then it looks, the optics just look terrible. And I think it's a problem they're dealing with. I'm not quite sure how it's going to end, frankly.
Well, it's interesting when we think of this whole issue of compensation and then when public money is involved with an entity. We saw with General Motors when the government had ownership of General Motors. Compare and contrast for us.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Treasury told General Motors, listen, if we're going to bail you out to the tune of almost $50 billion, I think it was 49.5 at one point, then we're going to have a say on executive compensation. They also took away their jet and a couple of other things. But the point is that when the public gets involved, you lose, when the public money gets involved, you lose some of the independence and the ability to set your own policies. And I think it's not an unfair comparison. Now, Gene Gargaro, from what I understand from my colleagues reporting, is going to be talking to the Oakland County people, I think, today. And one of the things that he has assured them is that they would consult with them on certain kind of compensation things on a periodic basis.
This is the DIA chairman who initially was kind of toughing it out, wasn't he, saying, hey, they've earned it, they did a good job. Go away? Wasn't that the initial response?
Yeah. Well, anybody who knows Gene Gargaro would know he would never say go away. Mm. I mean, he's a very gracious man, and a lot of people give him enormous credit for leading the museum through this very difficult time and now leading a $100 million fundraising campaign for the DIA's contribution to the grand bargain. But I think he's smart enough to understand and read the optics here and read the politics. The last thing they need is for the millage, the county support of the museum, to start unwinding. Because you got to believe that if one county, mm-hmm. Oakland, was to dissolve their arts authority, Macomb County wouldn't be far behind. Because the initial millage passed by a much wider margin in Oakland County than it did in Macomb County. And I think that a lot of politicians in Macomb would just be looking for an opportunity to unwind the relationship.
So
he's doing damage control, and I think he knows he needs to.
And do you think this promise of corrective action will be more transparent? We will meet with county art authorities when we talk compensation. Will it be enough, do you think, to settle the ruffled feathers?
Probably. I think it remains to be seen how it actually plays out, but I don't think there's any question that the museum, at least in the near term, as this unspools, is going to have to try a little bit harder to be more sensitive and more transparent to the community, and find ways to make itself more ingrained and integrated with the community in a way, say, that the Detroit Symphony Orchestra has done after its strike.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Seems just about everyone is worried about Ebola right now, even though health experts say there's next to no chance of an American outbreak. But there will be an outbreak this year that kills children, puts thousands of adults in the hospital, and sickens 10% of our population, the flu. Yet the Centers for Disease Control say fewer than half of all Americans actually get the flu shot. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells wondered, why not?
Clara is a nurse. She is required by her job to get her flu shot. But her 2-year-old daughter, Willa, she is not getting that shot.
I guess I don't see that the risks so much outweigh the benefits for her. I probably wouldn't get one myself if it wasn't required for my job.
We're only using Clara's first name so that we don't get her in any trouble at work. She's standing outside a grocery store, the kind of place now that can give you a flu shot in 2 minutes for $25. Her daughter is playing in the grocery cart seat.
She's vaccinated for other things, just not, I don't know, the flu shot every year.
Clara is not alone. The CDC says less than half of all Americans get their flu shots, even though it lands 20,000 little kids in the hospital each year. Last year, 3 Michigan kids died from flu complications. The year before, it was 7. So why aren't people motivated enough or confident enough to get the shot, even though it's safer, cheaper, and more accessible than ever before?
It's hard to know because it's a vaccine which has been around for a long period of time, a very good safety record. If there were problems with it, we'd know about it.
This is Dr. Arnold Monto. He is a professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan. And he says the most common misconception about the flu shot is that it can make you sick.
Nowadays, this inactivated vaccine is actually purified.
Monto says in the old days, extraneous parts of the virus could get in the vaccine, and that could maybe give you a fever for about a day. But not anymore. The shot cannot make you sick, says Monto.
The virus cannot reproduce itself.
Okay, but do you really need the flu shot? If you are a healthy adult, you are probably only going to get the flu once every 10 years. And even then, it's probably just going to be a couple of miserable days in bed.
I didn't see the point in getting a flu shot.
Even though you were an expert in public health.
It's a little embarrassing, isn't it? Yes.
Professor Andrew Maynard is the director of the University of Michigan Risk Science Center. But until last year, he had never gotten a flu shot. It just wasn't convenient. And it wasn't until he was making a video about the flu shot that he felt like, hey, I should probably get one of these.
The more people that get shots, the safer the group will be, especially those young kids that haven't got shots, though those people that are particularly vulnerable. So this is really a social duty.
But Maynard says our brains are just not very good at dealing with risk. For one thing, when a risk is familiar, like the flu, we are just less scared of it. While something like Ebola that seems new and out of control makes us far more concerned. Maynard says part of that is evolution's fault. We are plenty motivated when a tiger is chasing us, but when there is a slim chance that maybe we could get the flu and maybe pass that on to a kid who maybe will end up in the hospital.
That doesn't make sense on an emotional level. So at the end of the day, we just have to make the plunge. And we have to just trust somebody that this is going to be okay for us.
Still, public health experts agree that until flu shots are good for years, rather than something we have to get every 12 months, we're just never going to get everybody to get that shot. I'm Kate Wells, Michigan Radio News.
This, of course, is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Plenty of pink everywhere. The big push, of course, is awareness, as in don't forget to get your mammogram and donate to research. But there's a lesser told side of breast cancer, the financial hardships many patients endure as they go through treatment. Molly McDonald of Oakland County knows this all too well through her own breast cancer experience. That's why she founded the Pink Fund, a nationwide organization offering financial aid to breast cancer patients. By next June, they'll have paid out $1 million directly to patients' creditors. Molly, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
You were diagnosed with breast cancer in 2005. Tell us your experience.
Well, I was transitioning between jobs, and I had my annual mammogram, thinking that was really smart, get it under the health insurance from the previous job. And had no family history, never a lump or a bump, and my mammogram comes back suspicious. And of course, then I have a biopsy, and I'm in New York City on Friday, April 1st, pitching Major League Baseball, the graphics program for the All-Star Game that was going to be played in Detroit that July. The company I was about to join was on the short list to get the bid for the work, and my cell phone rings in the cab on the way back to LaGuardia, and my OBGYN, who had delivered all five of my children, now delivered the news that I had breast cancer. So that detoured my career plans to the off-ramp. The backstory was, like many women, I had been through a divorce. For me, it was financially devastating. I didn't have any savings, and now I had a COBRA premium of over about $1,200 a month to insure myself and my five children. So what was I going to do? Within 4 months, the house went into foreclosure, and in 6 months, I was standing in line at the local food bank at 11 Mile and Woodward in the basement of St. James Episcopal Church for food.
As you're going through treatment.
Mm-hmm. So that summer, I started actually brokering the kind of work that I was doing, and my new husband, who was self-employed in the luxury piano business, helped me. And we were able to cobble together some income, but we didn't have enough. So I met with other women who were in the treatment rooms, other working women who, like myself, their families depended upon their income for very basic needs. It wasn't for fluff. And they were on a family medical leave. They were concerned that leave was going to run out. They weren't going to be able to have their job back. They were plowing through their savings and what was going to happen. So when I couldn't get help for my circumstances, somehow there was a flip that switched in my brain and just said, what if I could give help? What if I could help one woman and her family from going through this? That would help make sense of this nightmare. So I took $50 that I should have saved for gas, and I bought a book called How to Form a Nonprofit Corporation and began what became the Pink Fund in October of 2006.
And the mission of the Pink Fund would be?
90 days of non-medical financial assistance paid to the patient's creditors for non-medical bills like health insurance premiums, housing, transportation, and utilities.
Give me a typical scenario of someone who calls you for help.
Well, first of all, they call, but we have our application readily available on the website. So basically, the scenario is they've been diagnosed with breast cancer, and they've either been forced to leave their position by signing a voluntary letter of resignation, or they're working, but their side effects are so challenging for them that they can no longer perform their job. And it's important for your listeners to understand that these side effects are the things that we hear about, like chemo brain, which is cognitive impairment. I mean, it's really forgetfulness. It's inability to sometimes put a sentence together. Another typical side effect is neuropathy. That would be the numbing of fingers and toes. So if you had a job that required lifting or even keyboarding all day, patients will tell us that they have to take the eraser head on a pencil to hit the keyboard because they just cannot use their fingers. And then there are mouth sores and digestive issues. So the side effects are such that working is very, very challenging. And for some patients, they work in hospital or care environments where they can't be around bodily fluids or toxic chemicals.
Because they're immune compromised.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then they really can't work. If they're fortunate, they work for a company that has 50 or more employees within a 75-mile radius of one location, and they can take advantage of the Family and Medical Leave Act. So they have 90 days of leave where they'll get their job back, but they don't have income. So now they have no paycheck. The other interesting part is that in the U.S., the average U.S. household income is $37,000. So how do you save for this rainy day? And in a recent study on credit in 2012, 51% of Americans reported they had less than $1,000 cash on hand.
And I know this is on the national radar screen, if you will, because we saw a study that was released earlier this year by University of Michigan's Comprehensive Cancer Center. And they say 4 years after being treated, a full 25% of breast cancer survivors say they are worse off financially. So I can tell that doesn't surprise you. But you're really hoping that more digging can be done and more research can be done to really measure a true impact of cancer on finances.
Yes. Recently, the Journal of Clinical Oncology in September came out with an actual report where oncologists are now looking at the financial toxicity as an actual side effect. And what does that mean? Does that mean medical copays? Does that mean job loss plus medical copays? Does that mean bankruptcy as a result of job loss plus medical copays? And how can doctors start to address this with patients in terms of maybe we need to sit down with Susie Smith and say, what's going to happen if you can't work while you're in treatment? Is your income the only income that your family has to have? Are you single? Do you have children? Do you have a partner or a spouse that provides income? Can we adjust your treatment protocol to adapt? Maybe we can. Maybe we can't. And I think it's great that these conversations are taking place because the patient often doesn't think about this. We always talk about, well, fighting for their lives. Patients in active treatment for any kind of cancer may lose their livelihood. Mm. Well, guess what happens? When push comes to shove, they will stop treatment and return to work.
And who knows what the outcome of that could be. I'm talking with Molly McDonald, who's a breast cancer survivor and the founder of the Pink Fund. They provide financial aid to breast cancer patients as they go through their treatment. That idea of financial toxicity it's a new voice in the conversation, mm-hmm. and it needs to continue.
It does. One of the things that happened for us recently is the Livestrong Foundation out of Austin, Texas, came out with a Big C competition to address all kinds of issues around patient-centric care. And one of them was financial health. So we entered and we got into the top 20. We got some money. We received some amazing coaching. But even to see that Livestrong, a global cancer organization, is looking at financial health. So what we're hoping to achieve is that we provide this 90 days of support, but we know in reality in breast cancer treatment, the average treatment protocol is 6 months. For some patients, it's a year to 18 months. Our 90-day bridge will allow them some breathing room to figure out what they're going to do next, but then how does the Pink Fund and other organizations step in to provide additional support? So our thought is we work with patient navigators. So we have a relationship with Baker College. This January, we're going to get their first graduating class of patient navigators who have to have on-site work experience to go into the hospital setting, who will come into our office and be supervised, and they will then be exposed and understand this non-medical financial aspect to the disease. These navigators will then be charged with finding other resources for the patient and act on their behalf to secure either additional financial funding. Maybe they need wigs, maybe they need lymphedema sleeves, maybe they need help with negotiating some bill payments. We're just going to be looking at all of that. One of the best things that happened recently is I met with someone from Detroit Edison, and Edison has a program that we're just beginning to look at where if you have a certain level of income, you can actually get your utility bill reduced. And I don't know enough about it to speak mm-hmm. on it intelligently right now, but for patients that come into us that meet that income level, then we can go in and get that bill reduced for them. We pay that bill at a reduced rate on their behalf, which frees up some cash for us to maybe pay another bill.
And I love the idea that these navigators can handle the kinds of things that the patient just can't deal with at that time.
They don't know. I mean, they call us up and they think that they've walked in our walk. We don't hold a walk. They're thinking that we're the Komen organization. Or they don't understand where they've sent their application. And that's the cognitive impairment that occurs. They're confused. They're overwhelmed. And so what we would like to do for those patients who meet our guidelines is really help extend that financial bridge. So while our funding is limited to 90 days, maybe we know of other funds mm-hmm. that are available and that we can refer them and actually apply on their behalf.
Molly, we were all kind of talking about, you know, the thrust with Breast Cancer Awareness Month and all things pink. At the same time, we were also contrasting with the ALS Association with the Ice Bucket Challenge, where they reportedly got more than $100 million in donations. Did the success of that social media push give you any thoughts as far as new approaches to fundraising?
Well, right now, I think we're experiencing some donor fatigue, especially in crowdfunding sites. I think the ALS Challenge was one of those one-hit wonders. It was amazing. Congratulations to ALS and to all the people who had fun with it. But we have seen other people try to pick up in the breast cancer space a similar type of thing, and it's just not going to happen. It's almost like the Livestrong yellow wristbands, right? That raised $30 million for Livestrong. For us, we have one little thing that we're doing. We have a song called One Less Worry that's on iTunes that was actually written by my daughter, Erin, to support the Pink Fund. And so for 99 cents, if you want to go to One Less Worry on iTunes or thepinkfund.org/onelessworry, your 99 cents can help support our organization. We're hoping to raise $150,000 that way. But when we look at crowdfunding, we used it for our Dancing with the Survivors event. It was held all over the United States with Fred Astaire Dance Studios. The dancers were crowdfunding on CrowdRise, which is a Michigan company, by the way. And we used it for Dancing with the Survivors. And it raised about $80,000. But nothing's going to compare to that ice bucket challenge.
The other thing I wondered is, speaking of fatigue, is there an issue with perhaps pink fatigue? There was a recent op-ed piece in the Washington Post from breast cancer survivor Leah Nurick, and she said, "I hate Breast Cancer Awareness Month." Here were her words: "I don't have to like the pink ribbon. I don't have to enjoy having my suffering reduced to a trite symbol that reflects nothing of the depth of sorrow that hundreds of thousands of women and their families have been forced to endure." She said she'd rather see the color of baby blankets and cotton candy dumped overboard, make it gray, make it black, or better yet, stop participating in the self-serving cult of pink. What are your thoughts when with an expression of that those words?
Well, as you can see, your listeners can't see, but I'm in all black.
You are in all black.
And when we came up with the name for our organization, we had to go with what was being marketed. I mean, the Pink Fund is pink. I'm in agreement with her. There's a lot of misuse of the color pink, the pink ribbon. I think consumers are being confused and often really don't know where the money goes. With the Pink Fund, we know where the money goes. We can tell you every single month where these bill payments go. But I look at some of this
pink stuff. Pink stuff.
Just flying recently, I purchased a bag of almond M&Ms, and they told me that 50 cents of my purchase was going to go to breast cancer awareness. And so I asked the stewardess, "What breast cancer awareness? What does that mean?" I hate that term, breast cancer awareness. I want specifics. And in fact, with our organization, the Attorney General in New York recommends a couple of things. Number one, if you align in a cause marketing platform, which can be very effective, the consumer needs to know what percentage of their purchase price or dollar amount is going to what organization that must be named during what time period with what minimum amount guaranteed. We have an arrangement that we work with Ford Warriors in Pink. We know year to year, year over year, they make a minimum contribution to us that's in writing. So Ford makes no money on the product whatsoever through the Warriors in Pink sale of products comes back to the Pink Fund.
Fascinating conversation, and I know there's going to be much more to uncover as studies are done to really take a deep, deep, deep dive into the financial impact. You can also find out more about the Pink Fund, how to help, how to get help. Just go to thepinkfund.org. Molly McDonald, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The spotlight this week is on one of the deepest college rivalries in sports, Michigan versus Michigan State. Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon is here. John, sum up for us what winning this game means if you're wearing maize and blue, and then if you're wearing green and white.
Maize and blue, it's survival. If Brady Hoke loses his game, the head coach, the pitchforks and torches come out, and your job is, if it's not lost, it is really close to being lost. And Michigan would have lost 6 out of the last 7 to quote-unquote little brother. And by the way, calling them little brother gets a bit old when they keep kicking your butt. So for Michigan, survival for Brady Hoke, and with that, probably Dave Brennan as well. Because if you lose your head coach, chances are very good, in my opinion, that the current AD, Dave Brennan, will not be permitted to run a search. So you got two big jobs and probably a lot of other jobs to go with it in the balance this weekend.
And what's at stake for the Spartans?
All the fun stuff, none of the unfun stuff. So the fun stuff is Big Ten title, Rose Bowl berth, possibly a berth in the Final Four playoff, and a real shot at a national title.
Wow. We think about how these two schools look in 2014 with Michigan with all the unfun stuff, as you put it, and Michigan State getting the fun stuff. Kind of interesting, isn't it, to go back to 2007 and that 28-24 Michigan win, and we had this moment with then pretty new Spartan coach Mark D'Antonio.
Are you aware the Michigan players met at midfield after the game and had a moment of silence in response to your comment after the Appalachian State game?
No, I'm not aware of that.
Any reaction to that? You find that amusing?
I find a lot of the things that they do amusing.
Do you have any
comments? They check themselves sometimes. But just remember, pride comes before the fall.
Anything in specific?
Pride comes before the fall.
What are your thoughts as you hear those words, John?
Those words are rather resonant these days, amongst Michigan fans especially. A little background. Michigan, of course, had this stunning defeat at the hands of Appalachian State in 07 to open the season. It's considered probably the greatest upset to this day in the history of college football. And when D'Antonio was told about that after that game, when he's on his own field that day, different game, he said a moment of silence, which was clearly a dig. So Michigan players, of course, after calling them little brother that year, same year, they had a moment of silence for Michigan State on the field after beating them up in East Lansing. So that was sort of some karma going that way, and perhaps some karma going back, as when you say the pride comes before the fall, certainly the last 7 years have not been very prideful for the Wolverines. They've won one time in six tries since then.
Why is this rivalry so personal?
It is a sibling rivalry in a way that Michigan-Ohio State is not, in a way that Michigan-Notre Dame is not, Michigan State-Notre Dame is not. And players from outside, even students from outside the state of Michigan, don't get it the first year. Bo Schembechler did not get it the first year. He had Ohio State circled. He's from Ohio himself. That's clearly a huge game. And he didn't realize until he lost to Michigan State up in East Lansing that, guess what, this game is as big as Ohio State. After that point, Bo said, this is now circled in green. These are our two big games.
What does Michigan need to do to pull off this upset? How does that need to play?
Several rabbits out of a hat. Look, on paper, Michigan has more talent. They recruit 4- and 5-star players. Michigan State recruits 2- and 3-star players. But you have to conclude the difference is coaching. Because Michigan State is not just beating Michigan these days, they're thumping them. Last year up in East Lansing, Michigan had negative 47 yards rushing against Michigan State. In other words, they're better off taking a knee than trying to run the ball at all. And if there are a few things I'm glad Bo Schembechler was not around to see, that's one of them.
Now, but Michigan State, things have not been smooth. Even though as they've been winning, there have been some white-knuckle moments for Spartan fans. So what do they need to do or not do to get the win?
Their defense is rock solid almost every game. A few cracks here and there, but not too many. The real thing is getting their offense in position to drive the ball down there. It's not a fancy offense, but it's good enough. What they really have to do is not turn the ball over. I realize it's an old cliche, but when you're the favorite, that's really what it boils down to. And to quote Bo, sorry about that, Spartan fans, the upset is in the mind of the favorite. In other words, the Spartans probably will not lose this game if they're going to play their best.
Can the defending Rose Bowl Spartans still have that same chip on the shoulder that we heard in D'Antonio's voice from 7 years ago?
Oh, hell yes. That chip is not going anywhere. There's no way. Look, when they were winning national titles in the 50s and 60s, the chip was still there. This is a permanent chip, and it's one they nurtured. I'm not insulting them by saying this. They pride themselves on this, and it gives them an edge going into the game. Trust me, I can't think of any reason why the Spartans would not be hungry for this game as well as the Wolverines.
Care to hazard a prediction? You don't have to.
No, the brain says if the Spartans get ahead in the third quarter, this one could get ugly. Because don't just watch the Spartan sideline because they will not let up. This is not a friendly rivalry. D'Antonio will keep the first team out there. They get a chance to crush them. They're going to crush them. Watch the Michigan sidelines if they get behind. See if they start giving up. And if that happens, the days are very much numbered for Polk and probably Brandon as well.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Latest circulation figures for the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press are out. Consider this. Where once the News and Free Press boasted sales of over 600,000 copies a day, the Free Press now has fewer than 20,000 daily subscribers and the News fewer than 100,000. Bill Thomas is here. His journalism career began in 1967. Before he retired in early 2012, Bill had been, among other things, executive editor of the Oakland Press, the publisher and editor of the Macomb Daily, and the editor of the Traverse City Record Eagle. And Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry is with us. Jack, you were the national editor of the Detroit News some 30 years ago. Today you teach journalism at Wayne State University. So you've got a professional and personal investment in these papers, and you use the term horrifying to describe the latest circulation figures?
Well, it is, but I think it is horrifying. And whatever you think of, I mean, the newspapers now are not in any sense the same entities that when I was there in the 1980s. But if you just think about it, the Detroit News has fewer than 1/10 the number of print subscribers that did that. It has some more digital subscribers. But together, these papers reach far less than half the number of people either paper reached 30 years ago. It's horrifying because that says something about how well-informed the people of Michigan, metropolitan Detroit, are.
Bill, what are your thoughts on the figures?
Jack's absolutely correct. But everybody tends to beat up on newspapers and predict their doom and gloom and all that type of thing. But I think the problem is more with newspaper companies, corporate problems, than they are newspapers. Corporations have really put the screws to newspapers. They've been mistreated. Staffs have been mistreated. And I think that's what's gotten a lot of the papers into the problems that they are today.
But how so? If the public isn't consuming, how does that have to do with what the corporations are doing?
Well, I think the public is consuming. The public has a thirst for knowledge, has a thirst for information. But what's happened to newspapers, and I think this is pretty well substantiated in internal studies by the newspaper industry, by certain groups, have demonstrated and documented that it's a corporate problem, not necessarily a newspaper problem. Now, is there a problem with circulation? Is there a problem with revenues? Absolutely. But what newspapers are facing now, newspapers as entities, are facing what I call the results of a perfect storm of corporate greed and corporate debt and a collapsing economy. And newspapers have struggled. Newspapers, again, as entities, have been struggling back against that.
Well, that's exactly right. One thing, and of course, Bill is a publisher. I should defer to him. But most companies operate, most businesses, on a profit margin of maybe 4 to 5%. The grocery store industry is less than that. But you have newspaper companies like Gannett want their papers to return 30% profit or more. If they were content with the kind of profit margins most of American business has, there wouldn't be this kind of crisis, would there, Bill?
No, absolutely, Jack. Absolutely. And newspapers have begun to be treated all over the course of the last, oh, let's say, 15, 20 years as chattel. They've been bought and sold, and which has increased the debt. It's almost, I've referred to it as almost like a Ponzi scheme. These companies, particularly these bottom feeder companies, got into it, bought these papers at exorbitant prices, and then had to buy more papers at exorbitant prices to keep the revenue and the cash flow coming in. At the same time, the papers have suffered, and as Jack said, the profit margins have remained inexcusably high.
Jack, I posted your commentary about the circulation figures on Facebook to see what listeners had to say, and across the board, the common theme was, well, we can read what we want online for free. What problem do you see with that argument?
Well, that people think that, and that's kind of astonishingly ignorant. The problem is that newspapers still, even now, are by far the major producers of news content. What aggregators, what places like Google do, is they collect stories from newspapers and put them online. Well, if the chickens aren't laying eggs, sooner or later, the store isn't going to have any eggs, no matter how many stores there are. And that's what people forget. I mean, some place, Michigan Radio, to its credit, does create content, but virtually no broadcast media do anymore. They repeat newspapers. They chase stories done by newspapers. And so the big problem to me is in places like Ann Arbor or the state of Michigan. You can find tons of Barack Obama or Jennifer Aniston news, but you can't find news about your state or in many places, even your local community. And to me, that's very dangerous from the standpoint of democracy.
Again, Jack's absolutely right. The thing that we've got to his comment about democracy is absolutely correct. We've moved away to a large degree from, we've forgotten our mission. And years ago, the mission was to make a profit. Everybody has to make a profit. There's no question about that. But for all intents and purposes, the profit was to do good journalism in addition to making people wealthy. But we've moved away from being the stewards of a public trust and the First Amendment, stewards of the First Amendment, to just pocketing a bunch of cash and making corporate executives wealthy. And that's wrong. And what they did, they were asleep at the switch when reader patterns were changing. As I said, the thirst for news and information is still there. I remember back in the 80s, I think it was, there was a researcher, I think he worked for Knight Ridder at the time, and he predicted back in the 80s that today's newspaper would be in a tablet form, very much like we have today. And rather than follow this and invest in this kind of technology and looking down the road to see where newspapers would be, the news industry would be in 20, 30 years from now, they just the corporations just continued to rake in the profits and rake in the money, not reinvesting in themselves. And then all of a sudden, oops, the reader patterns have changed as they were predicted, and people have gotten away from reading the tangible newspaper, the black and white newspaper.
And Jack, some of the comments on Facebook, somebody commented they don't see a problem. That it's a natural evolution of form. And here was the quote, the responsibility of a news organization is to inform its audience. It doesn't have to do so in printed form any more than radio has to be delivered to an actual radio.
The problem is that this is a capitalist for-profit society, and newspapers, their basis of their profit, of their income, was never getting people to pay for the black and white paper. It was classified advertising. Advertising in general, but classified advertising in particular. And that's all migrated to the internet for free. So the problem now is not really the form of a newspaper. I mean, as a dinosaur, I like paper newspapers, but if people got the same stuff online, on tablets, on their phones, that's fine, except you need the economic basis to support gathering the news. Gathering the news is an expensive, labor-intensive proposition, especially any kind of investigative report, looking at records. You have to have a way to pay for that, and that is the root right now of much of this crisis.
And to both of you, do you have thoughts on how we do find a way to pay for and deliver the journalism that we need to be an informed democracy?
Well, once again, what happened in the transition maybe 10 or 15 years ago was when things started going more to the web, when newspapers were losing classified advertising. There were those that said that, oh, we can't charge for this. We can't charge online for this. Well, you can, and now they're shifting more to paywalls and pay for the information. Now, is this, again, the companies fell asleep at the switch. They got all caught up in web technology, that type of thing, and never put a lot of thought into how they were going to finance and how they were going to raise enough money to produce news stories and news copy. It is expensive. But again, they left the horse out of the barn. Now, how they're going to get it back in and continue to bring in revenue is a challenge, and it might not be possible in the long run.
And Jack, I think of those journalism students sitting in your classroom today. What do you think the future holds for them, for the tomorrow's news reporters and editors?
Well, that's a very good question. I think there'll always be a demand for people who can find information and can write and communicate and present that information well. I think there's going to be a demand in society for information. Robert Kaiser, who was a managing editor of the Washington Post, just retired this year, wrote recently that he was hoping that there was some kid in a garage in Silicon Valley somewhere coming up that'll invent an application that'll enable information to be profitable. I'm very lousy at seeing the future, but it seems to me it might be likely that newspapers may go back to what they were in the early years of this country before the penny press. Newspapers will be pretty expensive, but they'll exist and people will pay for them, people who really need information. The only trouble with that is you sort of have two societies, an informed one and an ill-informed one, and that's not good in the long run for your society.
And speaking of the Post, as we speak, we've heard the news that Washington Post editor Ben Bradley has died, and I've got two veteran newspaper folks on the line here, so I would really like to get your thoughts on what Ben Bradley meant for journalism and for newspapers. Bill?
Oh, Lord. Ben Bradley was every editor and I think staff member writer's idol. That's the way everyone wanted it to be forever. And they don't make them like Ben Bradley anymore. And it's just a major, major loss, I think. I was troubled a little bit by one of the comments in the Washington Post obituary of Bradley this morning. He was in the company cafeteria and just not long ago. And there were people, there were employees of the Washington Post who didn't even know, young people who didn't even know who he was. And that's a shame because, God, we can't ever forget the likes of Ben Bradley and John Knight of Knight Newspapers. They were the they made it fun.
They made it fun. They were courageous. And one of the obituaries I was reading about Bradley said that he led with his gut and his instincts. He was not a guy who would look at focus groups. He wouldn't want any kind of survey from a marketing firm telling him what people wanted to be reading about. If somebody had given him one, he would have answered it with a profanity. He just trusted that he knew what news was, he knew how to find it, and his genius was that he hired good people. He said he always wanted to hire people smarter than he was, and he supported them, gave them their heads. If you want to see what he was like, the best portrayal, I think, is the marvelous job Jason Robards did in All the President's Men. That was Ben Bradley, and that's why people would have gone through a brick wall for him.
Jack, Bill, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Cindy.
Take care. My pleasure.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's political analyst. He also teaches journalism at Wayne State University. Bill Thomas is a longtime newspaper editor and publisher who retired in 2012.